been brutal in Santa Barbara recently, hasn't it? I was traveling on Memorial Day when I got the news that my friends here were grappling with the deaths of friends, one even at her doorstep. And we're brought face to face with the world again, aren't we? The world that isn't resting in Jesus, but is living a broken life. And we grapple with it every day in a variety of ways. That was graphic and heart-wrenching and brutal. But one minute we're watching the news and wondering, maybe you were, how can an airplane go missing? How does that happen? The whole plane's gone. Then you're reading the news and women are grabbed in a village and taken off to places we don't know, and unspeakable things are happening. We live in a broken world, and our heart breaks. We live in a broken world, and we're somehow loving Jesus and finding our rest in Him, but the rest of the world knows nothing of it, and we're left to struggle through the challenges. Sometimes our challenges are huge. Someone got a memorial in front of their house, right? That someone died there. Others are trivial but important to us. We're struggling with the exam that's coming. We're struggling with finding a job. We're frustrated about a boss who just doesn't get it for whatever reason. I have a couple of those, right? You grapple with your days and you go to work and you love your work, but there's parts you don't like. Maybe you want work and you don't have it. You're ready. There's probably someone in your family that's sick. Maybe you're sick and you don't know why. It's a broken world that we live in. And I would challenge you and commend you for being here to find your hope in the living God and to have friends that we fellowship and work with, celebrate with, sing with. Thank you. Russ, Shara, and I have been doing that for 26 years together. So Russ is the one who called me. Russ had a mini challenge, not nearly so big as the big earth-shattering news, but his was good news. He and Julie are vacationing. He loves to be here, but couldn't be here. Your pastor's gone. He's traveling. And so they went to the B string, and they said, who else is out there that we can get? Russ and I have shared a lot of history together. Russ and I and our families, we've raised our kids together. We met at a church here in town. We led a Bible study together, Bible study fellowship. We did that because our wives were in it. I'm famous and probably should have a disclaimer. My wife is Joyce Berg. If you didn't get the Randy Berg part, the Berg part is Joyce Berg, and she led Bible study fellowship for a lot of years. And so Russ and I can call on each other in the hard times, and this was a little bit of a pickle. So he called me and said, hey, I've been telling you about this great group, and he loves teaching here, and we share stories over golf and social events. And so he said, could you help me out? And so I'm glad to be here on that. He knew that that I could, no matter what, I wouldn't stray from the truth. I might not be as good a teacher as Russ. But we share this, and we know this from kind of living life together, that the Creator, the God of the universe, is at work. He, God, created the world. That's a fundamental principle of what we believe. And if you're visiting today, maybe you've come with a friend, or you're trying to figure out what this gospel thing is, or maybe you've been in church forever and you just need to be reminded. Let's just talk about what the gospel is, because that's what Russ can trust me to bring to you, because we've shared it and communicated it to each other. God created the world, not you and not me. It wasn't an accident. And man came along and messed it up. We had the opportunity to live in a perfect garden with a perfect God, and we chose to act like God and left that path. And it had consequences. For the world that we live in, it's broken because of that choice. For us, we're broken. For those that were around, it's a mess. People die. People are sick. There's weeds in the garden. Nevertheless, we were the high point of God's creation, and we're called to be at work in it. And that call to be at work in the world that God's given us didn't change, but the location did, and our brokenness changed it. And in the very next breath, almost, from when we blew it, God made a promise. And he said, I'm going to fix it. Not it might be fixed, not that something unusual will happen. He said, stay tuned. I promise you, I will make this right. And that's in Genesis chapter 3. If you've missed that, it's early in the Bible story. God tells us, not only did I make the world, not only did you blew it, I am going to fix the world. I'm going to crush Satan, right? I'm going to crush him. And he may bruise my heel, but I will conquer. And so in the first three chapters of the Bible, we have most of the gospel. And then God takes the rest of what we call the Old Testament to unveil his story of calling a people to himself, and then reveals his son, the promised Savior from Genesis, to give us the grace that we need and show us that he has called us to be in his family and provided a way to do that. And then he promises, as a result of that, to have an eternity with God. So those are the four points of the gospel. If I asked you, or if your neighbor asked you, what is the gospel? Could you give some version of that? I would challenge you. As men and women of God, you're commended to me as people who love to study. Sometimes you need to boil it down to its essence. It's not more complicated than that. It's much more rich than that. And it takes 66 books and thousands of years and many writers to explain it. But it's that simple, the gospel of Jesus Christ, that we believe we have a God who created us, we've messed it up, we have a hope for salvation in Jesus Christ alone, and we have a hope for eternity. So Russ knows that I can at least see that. We could end the sermon right now, you've heard the gospel, and we could go home. Okay, it'd be the shortest sermon ever. I guess there's people at 10:30 that are going to give me the stink eye, so wouldn't have to worry about that. We'll be done. But I think there's a couple ways that we can be encouraged this morning in this challenge that comes from Isaiah. I wanted to make another quick connection before we got there, and that is I was married by an evangelical free church pastor. But we attended a little evangelical free church. You may have heard of it. It's in Fullerton, and there was this guy, Chuck Swindoll. Yeah, studied under Chuck for 10 years when I was down in L.A., so we love the Free Church. We appreciate the ministry that the church has to offer as a group. My in-laws actually spent time in the Philippines as evangelical Free Church missionaries. But in this world that Russ and I live in, that you live in, there are challenges. Most of you are young, and some of the biggest hurts maybe are still in your future. You may have known some. Russ and I shared and grieved with a mutual friend whose wife lost her fourth child a week before it was born. And we shared the gospel with them. But it was a lot like sitting. And challenges. I know you have challenges now. And it's not so different than what was happening in Israel. Students of the Word will remember that after God created the world and he set on a path to redeem the world through his people, they took various paths, but at some point he called a man out of Ur, and he sent that man with his family to Egypt, and out of that few people, 1 million people leave Egypt, and God promises a land for them. He promises to make them a people after God's own heart. God is at work calling a people to do his work, and they left, and they were in Israel, and they subdued the land. They actually listened, at least after a detour of 40 years. Remember that part? But anyway, they listened. They got back into Israel, and they had a king, and they loved their God, and he established himself in the temple, and it seemed for a short season that all was good in the world. Their charter, though, even then, was to reach the rest of the nations. They were to be a blessing to the islands. They were to be a blessing to the sojourners. They were to be an example of taking care of the land that God gave them, and they forgot. And other people took advantage of that. And pretty soon the kingdom's divided, and kings aren't paying attention to God. And so the kingdom divides. It looks a lot like, here's the simple version of history in Israel, right? It looks like what would have happened in the United States if we'd lost the Civil War. We got a North and a South kingdom, and it's a mess. And some kings follow God and some kings don't. And finally, half of the kingdom gets taken off into captivity and the other half is on the verge of maybe getting taken into captivity, and that's where Isaiah comes in. Isaiah is one of the prophets that God has called to speak truth to these people who are afraid that they'll end up like their friends and brothers and sisters and cousins who have gone away, and he is probably a quite educated man in the city of Jerusalem. He's quite articulate. He's really a beautiful poet, so we think that he's in actually the center of the city, and it seems, historians seem to think that maybe even it's connected to the rulers. He's like a cousin to the king. God uses all kinds of people, doesn't he, when he speaks his truth. I love the prophets because that's a good example of all kinds of people. My favorite prophet is Amos. He's the fig picker of Tekoa. That wasn't a guy that was sitting in the court, but God called him to speak truth, and I like him especially because he's a minor prophet, which means he used fewer words to say just as important things. And he got right to the point. Oh, you fatted cows of Bashan, right? He just came after him. Isaiah takes a lot longer, but the message is similar. Let's return to God. So the difference between these minor prophets and major prophets really is how many words it takes. So we'll give the major prophets sort of the scholarship award, right? They went to UCSB. They got a lot of words and can write big papers because that's how they're judged. And then the other guys went to small little private schools like me where you write a short paper and you get done. So let's go to Isaiah. He's in this mess. He's in this mess, and he's called to speak the word of truth, and he's called to encourage the people of the Lord, and he's brought truth in a variety of ways. But because we're in a hard place, and because maybe you are facing a challenge like these people, I thought perhaps these words, which I'll confess are maybe my favorite passage in the whole Bible, would be encouraging to you. We're going to start in 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So the other beautiful part of this is this passage breaks into kind of a beautiful symmetry. Isaiah's not only a man of words, but I think it's sort of Hebrew poetry. The beautiful part of Hebrew poetry, it translates to whatever language you're in, because it's not necessarily a rhyme, but it's a rhythm. He's going to tell us about God. So we have a picture of God. And then we're going to spend a few minutes talking about a priority check, because that's what Isaiah did to those people. And then he's given us a promise of renewal. And so in this passage, we can come to understand a bit about God. Isaiah, the whole book, is just laced with deep, intimate, beautiful knowledge of who God is and what he's about doing. And this little section, I think, is a synthesis of that. This is certainly not meant to be an exhaustive theology of all that God is. But it's a picture that we can fall back on of who he is and then flesh out in other parts of Scripture. He challenges us if we've heard him, because what he wants us to do is come to look at God. And he says of him, he is the everlasting God. So he starts with this high transcendent view of who God is. Really the biggest view we can have of him. Theologian Fred Kloster says this about this view of God. Eternity may be defined as that perfection of God which expresses his transcendent and respect to time. God has neither beginning nor end. He does not undergo growth, development, or maturation. He exists before the world. He dwells even now in eternity, and he will continue as the eternal God even when history is ended. Goes on to say the infinity of God is sometimes considered as absolute perfection, which characterizes all God's attributes as limitless and perfect. So he starts at the very core of who God is, having no beginning, having no end, embodying all that a God could be. And he then builds his hope on what we should look to for our help. It's not an Old Testament concept, though, is it? Jesus said, I am the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega, or we might say the A and the Z. He claimed to be that God, and he lived it in a perfect way. That has implications for us today, though, doesn't it? You know people with gods, and their gods are not infinite. They're quite limited. In fact, what about us? We sometimes make ourselves a God. We occupy a span of time. God does not. We have limits. He does not. We have a body. He does not. Our perspective is about this wide, right? We see our little view of our world. God sees it all. Not only all that's happening now, but all that has happened and all that will happen over time and space. We're limited in our knowledge. He is not. Can I ask you something? How big is your God? Wilbur Ries grappled with this idea a few years ago, and he really kind of ironically came up with this idea of what he wanted from God. I'd like to buy $3 worth of God, please. Not enough to explode my soul or disturb my sleep, but just enough to equal a cup of warm milk, a snooze in the sunshine. I don't want enough of God to make me love a black man or pick beets with a migrant. I want ecstasy, not transformation. I want warmth of a womb, not really a new birth. I want a pound of eternal in a paper sack. I'd like to buy $3 worth of God. How much of God do you want? The whole thing? Beginning to end? Eternal? Infinite? I wonder if you could sing with the children. I love to go back to the simple songs, right? How my God is so big. You sing that in Sunday school. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do. In the challenges of Isaiah's life, he encouraged us to gaze in the majesty and the purity of a perfect God. When you encourage your friends about a hard time that they're going through, probably not that person died on their stoop, but might have been. Some people at the church I go to have that person to talk to. Where do you start? Where do you start when it's just tough? It was a bad week. You blew it. Ah, your grumpy boss. He's grumpy because you blew it. Where do you start? Is it that there's an infinite God whose family you can be a part of? If you're not in that family, you may want to know about that. There are people that would love to talk about that. But those of us, and I think many of us here are there, would claim to be in his family. Do we start with the fact that he is an eternal God that loves his world and his creator? Let's talk about that creation. It's not in vogue right now, except to debate what he meant when he created it. But it says in this is so. Let's see, Isaiah. Oops, sorry. Flip my page. The everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. Isaiah's debate wasn't how it happened. Interesting. Thoughtful, provocative, is that it happened at God's hand. That the world was created by God for God's purpose isn't an idea that's written in philosophical papers, and in fact it's disdained by those that would claim to be scientific, and yet there are scientists that can show you a bigger hand than a butterfly flapping its sort of metaphorical wings eons ago created a rush of atoms that turned into a happenstance that led to some soup that developed into molecules that turned into people. I'm not sure how God created the earth. I'm not going to pretend to say I was there. In fact, in Job, when people tried to pretend they were there, he said, "Where were you when I did it?" That's his problem. But he did it. That's different than the rest of the world. You can rest on the fact that God is the creator. And that's how the story, this beautiful story of God's work in the world starts. Those simple words, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We can rest on that. It's not our world, it's his world, and he created it for his purpose. And Isaiah wants us to get back to the beginning. This God, bigger than all time and space, created the world for his purpose. And there's what we believe. The purpose has, the creation has a purpose for those not there. And Paul reminded us of that in Romans chapter 1. And I'm going to read 18 through 23. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. You may not be the most articulate person. You may not be able to challenge people's view of science, but they're left without excuse because they can see these mountains, his stars. Our creator has given us a beautiful picture of his own power. And people throughout the ages have looked to that power. David looked to the hills. He knew that's where his help came from. If you want a longhand version of that and you have time and need a reminder beyond my sort of Reader's Digest version here in Isaiah, Job got into it with God, and God straightened Job out, and it took about four chapters of God straightening Job out in one part. So 38 through 41 is a beautiful picture of God's creation from his voice to Job, and Job had to kind of step back and say, "Oh, sorry, got out of place." So what are the implications of a creator God? We need to recognize that he changes things. And we sing about them because our heart's rooted in the confidence that his plan has a purpose. It wasn't an accident. The situation that we're in today in Santa Barbara is part of his plan for his purpose, and he's using it. And by the way, he's a creator God, and we were created to do work for him. We had work in the garden. Work wasn't a post-fall event. Pre-fall event. We're to be about serving God. It's not that we earn our salvation, but we're challenged. Don't forget that part. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, not to get it, to exercise it and to know it. Our beautiful God, who's our creator, doesn't get tired. It says here, he does not faint or grow weary, and his understanding is unsearchable. So this growing faint or tired, I think its specific implication is that he didn't do, as some deists might think, spin the world up, send it off, and say, "I'll get back to you in a couple million years." Or even maybe when I send Jesus, and he sort of touches on these high points of history. That might be satisfying to the degree that it allows us to do what we want, but it's not the picture that God has when from that beginning until today, he's been at work, active, and he's not tireless in his work of making his plans and his self known in this world. So how did that happen? And how is it even true today? Well, we can think of the Old Testament ways, right? He flooded the world, and then he broke down a tower, and then he sent a people off to Egypt, and then he saved those people, and then he came as a man, and spoke truth to us, and then he left. But that's not really the whole story, is it? as he was leaving, he said, "Stay tuned, it won't be long. More involvement's coming." And it wasn't long, it was measured in days, that Pentecost occurred. And at Pentecost, the Holy Spirit came. And guess what? The God of the universe has been indwelling his church from that day forward, having an effect on this world. God is still active. He's not tireless. The church is here. You are a tribute to the fact that God is at work today in this place. And there's work to do on the campus, at your work, in this community. And that's God's work. He's working through his church. It's exciting to think that he's not done. And I went to a class called Perspectives. Have you heard about that yet? Awesome class. If you never took a missions class, it's awesome because it gives you this view of what God's doing today. It's not just the old guys that went somewhere. It's the young people that are at work. They said this thing that I remember. The person that will bring the gospel, the good news of Christ, to the last unreached group will probably be born in the next few years. We're that close. And they'll probably be born in China. Their quote. Meaning, it's probably not an American invention, and someone in the world today is going to be the person that with the knowledge of the gospel goes and reaches those people. We're getting close. But in the meantime, God's still at work. God is at work now, and he's still at work reaching the people that are out in the world. And we get to be a part of that in his timing and for his purpose. Do you have a plan? How are you at work? How are you taking advantage of God being at work? Are you serving? I met a wonderful group that's very active here. Was that the 20% that's doing 80% of the work? I'm just asking. I'm not from here. But that's pretty true of most churches. But where are you at work in God's kingdom plan? It includes your work. It includes this community, this place that needs the gospel. It includes businesses that are broken and fallen and need people to help them work, not just efficiently, but nobly, with a great cause. So the best is the last, I guess. I mean, he talks in Isaiah's terms here about his understanding is unsearchable, and that's a little bit like saying it's so big you can't understand it, I think. There's no searching his understanding, the King James Version says. The New International Version says, his understanding no one can fathom. I don't pretend to fathom things that no one can fathom. But again, I go back to Job, and I read through Job, and I see that God is at work explaining who he is and what he's done. And he says, my ways are not your ways. I have to acknowledge that there's a God beyond who I am and what he does. I went to some smart guys, John Piper and Justin Taylor, and they, smart guys as they are these days, they went to a guy named Jonathan Edwards. American pastor, man of God, who preached in many venues with a God-entranced vision of all things. And they said of him, Jonathan Edwards, trying to get their hands around who this God is, God is the beginning, the middle, and end of all things. Nothing exists without his creating it. Nothing stands in being without his sustaining word. Everything has its reason for existing for him. Therefore, nothing can be understood apart from him, and all understandings of all things that leave him out are superficial understandings. Since they leave out the most important reality in the universe, we can scarcely begin to feel today how God is being ignored because it's in the very air that we breathe. Having a God that's inscrutable does not allow us to presume that we know who he is or how he works. It doesn't allow us to presume we know his plan, but it's ours to be in it and to ask him to guide us and direct us in it. It's ours to accept that when it doesn't go our way, when my friend's unborn baby dies, when someone dies on our stoop, God's at work. It's his plan and his ways. His ways are inscrutable, but ours are to serve him in it. And finally, in verse 29, in a beautiful twist of a truth that we often think of, He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. The twist, I mean, to talk about is that it's not just that he's a powerful God, he is a power-giving God. Did you see that? God is powerful. That's a different characteristic. He gives power to people. That's a different kind of a God. He's not taking it. He's distributing it for his purposes and in his time. We saw it at Pentecost. But it's happening today. The church is at work serving God around the world by the power of God. And Paul reminded us of that. Maybe you're anxious and worried, and like Timothy, have a responsibility but are a little afraid of it. Paul challenged him and he looked at him and he wrote to him and Timothy and he said, God has not given us a spirit of timidity but of love and power and discipline. So that's how God works. So all of that is to say we have a God worth worshiping and serving, and those who wait on that God, they shall renew their strength. Wait is often interpreted or translated hope, those who hope in the Lord. If you're tired today, if you're frustrated, if you're hurt, and you need strength beyond who you are and what you've done, the Lord will give it as we look to him. David says in the Psalms, my soul, be thou careful for nothing except God. Cast all my care on him. He careth for thee and maketh this thy great concern. I love the King James sometimes, right? Make this thy great concern, to love and serve him. Jesus said the same, right? Matthew chapter 6. Don't be anxious for anything. What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or shall we wear? What shall we wear for the Gentiles? Seek these things. As for you, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and those things will be added to you. It's in the seeking of God that we find the power of God, and it's in his service that he unleashes it for us. And so my challenge to you, brothers and sisters, today, waiting on God is to see who he is and to serve him with the gifts that he's given you in the place that he's put you, and remind each other of this great gospel gift when you or your friends are discouraged. God's at work, and he will prevail. He's promised us that. And that's not the final part. As we finish and we look at the very end of this passage, even though we've gone weary, when we look to God, we have new strength. And we have this great hope. When we wait, we will mount up with wings on eagles, and we shall run and not grow weary, and we shall not walk and not be faint. Prophets have two messages that they bring, and it's beautiful as you dig deep into the understanding of all those guys, from Amos to Isaiah to Jeremiah. They usually spoke to an issue of the day. You're about to be captured, and I'm going to tell you how that's going to happen, and then it would happen, which would then give them credibility to say, God's at work in the world, and he is making his plan known, and there's a bigger view on the other side of this where God prevails and wins. And so, in fact, in this beautiful little phrase that we can be rested and encouraged and walk today with hope, but it's because in the end we stand with God and have a vision of the future. A future that God has promised, where we can be hopeful in. Thank you for the opportunity to look at Isaiah and look at who God is. And I hope that this week, as you're discouraged, you can find yourself resting in the joy of what thou art.